The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Live from West Babylon, New York, this is Sports Talk 1240.
Well, good evening and hello again, everybody. Welcome to hour number one of Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB Freeport, Long Island, New York. Bill Donahue taking you through the first hour on this Sunday night, the 25th day of September. Our engineer Brian Graves is across the way. We've got a nice show lined up for you tonight. Up first, we'll talk to former Met and longtime fan favorite Howard Johnson. He'll join us. In the second half, we'll welcome in tennis legend and the winner of the most singles titles in the history of the game, Rod Laver, will be here. He's got a new autobiography fittingly called Rod Laver, an Autobiography. So sit back and relax. Enjoy Sports Talk 1240 tonight on WGBB. Got some great stuff ahead in the next few hours. As always, before we begin, I invite you to follow us on our Facebook page, cleverly titled Sports Talk 1240. There you'll find sports information, show information, and more. So stop by, give us a look. Then you can click and give us a like. You can also follow us on Twitter at Sports Talk 1240. And all past shows can be heard on our website at www.sportstalk1240.com. Well, my first guest is a fan favorite, as we said, among Mets fans, a member of the legendary 1986 World Championship team. He's a two-time world champion, a two-time All-Star, and he ranks third on the all-time Met list for home runs, RBIs, doubles, and stolen bases. Most recently, he was the manager for the California League champion High Desert Mavericks, an affiliate of the Texas Rangers. I welcome to Sports Talk 1240 tonight, Howard Johnson. Howard, good evening.
Hey, Bill, how you doing?
It's great to have you with us, Ojo. Growing up in Clearwater, down there in Florida, great area. You went to Clearwater High School down the road from the mall there. Who were your favorite teams and players and idols growing up in Florida, Howard?
Well, I guess, you know, in Clearwater, I definitely was a Phillies fan growing up because, they trained right there. Mike Schmidt was a big influence on me for playing third base.
Right.
Wore number 20 because of him in my senior in high school. And as a fan of Phillies, I loved Harry Callis on the radio. I used to listen to him a lot. And so I just kind of grew up with that. I used to love Oakland. I was a big A's fan also when I was younger. Loved uniforms, as probably most people did, and Reggie Jackson and all that. So it was a good time. It was a good time for baseball at that point.
Sure was. Now, are you still a Bucks fan?
I'm a huge Bucks fan. I'm watching the lightning delay right now.
Yeah.
So there's two minutes left.
For those folks who are unaware, there's a lightning delay down at Raymond James Stadium in Tampa, and the Bucks and the Rams are held up right now due to a lightning warning in the area. And Hojo, who were some of your favorite Bucks through the years?
Oh man, I've been a fan since the first day. I love Doug Williams.
Oh yeah,
probably the guy. He's the guy really, him and Leroy Selman, those two guys. They're the franchise.
They are.
Cornerstones. And you got John McKay, head coach. He just had that humor that people kind of endeared themselves to. And it's one of those teams that you follow. They got to 0-26, and when they finally won their first game at New Orleans, and I couldn't wait to get there for the last game of the year when they played the St. Louis Cardinals back in Tampa, and they won that game. And I think it was the next year is when they got to such a great start and almost got to the Super Bowl, losing to the Rams there 9-0.
Yeah.
So I remember those days well.
The old popsicle-colored uniform days, exactly.
Yeah.
Now, you were a pitcher in high school, Howard. The Tigers, when they drafted you, they converted you from a pitcher to an infielder. How'd you feel about that?
Well, what happened was they drafted me, and they said I would have the opportunity to both if one didn't work out, And so I started out playing shortstop, and after about 30 games, they moved me to third base. They said, hey, this is the idea. We feel like you got a chance to be one of our third basemen in a couple of years in the big leagues. And I'm like, oh, I said, really? I said, all right, I'm all down for that. So I spent my first 2 years in Lakeland and played third primarily and learned an awful lot. So that's kind of when things started to happen for me. My second year in pro balls when I had kind of a breakout year and had a real good season for Lakeland that year and set me up for winter ball and stuff like that that kind of helped me get to the big leagues quick.
Sure. How was it playing for Sparky Anderson in Detroit?
It was good. It was an experience because, you know, he's a Hall of Fame manager and he was legendary, you know, at that time. And just, you know, Sparky Anderson, you know, everybody knows who he is. And, you know, he's one of those guys that, pushed you for sure. He's really favored the older player as opposed to the younger player.
Uh-huh.
And there's a couple of times where I was on the wrong end of his, you know, doghouse, but you know, things happen along the way. Not for anything that I did, but just that he didn't have the trust in the younger guys you do as the older guys. So you just kind of have to learn how to deal with it.
Sure. Now you came to the Mets in exchange for the pitcher Walt Terrell, who came from the Texas Rangers with Ronnie Darling. That left the Mets with three third basemen. But 3 days later, the Mets send Ubi Brooks in a trade to Montreal for a guy named Gary Carter. Now, you're platooning at third with Ray Knight. How did you feel about being the lefty side of that platoon?
I was good with it. I mean, I knew Davey from when I was younger and when he was in the Phillies. And I remember, you know, he telling me that, hey, you're gonna hit against right-handed pitching. The goal is, you know, we want you to be the everyday guy, but we have Ray here. We're gonna platoon you guys, so mm-hmm. It'll work out for both. And Davey was big on that. He was big on the platoon. He used tough one back then the next year,
right,
you know, on second base. He's, you know, me and Ray, and even had Danny Heap and Kevin Mitchell in the outfield, and you had Mookie and Lenny, you know, the following year. So you had situations where you know, you have a left-right, you know, scenario with the platoon, and it wasn't a big deal. It was just kind of the way we were put together.
Right. We're speaking to Howard Johnson tonight on Sports Talk 1240. Davey really knew how to get the most out of his players. And one example of that, Howard, is that famous night that people may remember at Riverfront Stadium in Cincinnati when Eric Davis slides into Ray Knight, comes up face-to-face, and Ray Knight throws him a right in the face, and both benches empty. Now, Davey's got two pitchers in the lineup. Tell us a little bit about that night.
Well, Carter was catching, and I was playing shortstop. I came in the game. I don't know if I came in as a pitcher. I know I homered later, but I came in the game as a pinch hitter for Santana, I believe, and I was in short when that all happened with Ray and Eric Davis. And so that happened. Those guys, you know, the bench is cleared.
Right.
Ray got it. Ray was ejected. So Carter went to third. I stayed at short, and we had McDowell and Orozco playing the outfield.
Right.
And Davey would come out, and depending on who was up, you know, he'd bring one guy in, put the other guy over. And, you know, we tried to play it like that. And we got to that point because Dave Parker was up to fly ball in the ninth inning, which he was a tremendous right fielder, but he dropped the ball.
He did, right.
Tied the game up. He had all the stuff with the pitching. And, you know, we found a way to win. That was kind of the mark of our team. We could adapt. And we would find a way.
Definitely. You sure did. Now, we'll move into the playoffs in 86. The famous Game 6, I remember that, watching that in a bar in Manhattan, the 16-inning affair. Where did you fit in during that game?
I came in as a pinch hitter I think it might have been for the pitcher because we had double-switched earlier in the game. So I think I came in. And I faced an ex-teammate of mine who passed away a couple of years ago, Aurelio Lopez.
Uh-huh.
He came in with a runner on third, one out, and he threw me a high fastball, and I popped it up. I couldn't get the run home. The very next inning was the inning that Billy Hatcher hit the home run to tie. And I was already out of the game because I came in and went for the 1-AD. And we ended up winning, you know, later on. But it was – I fit into that game kind of there. for myself, I had an opportunity to drive in a run and couldn't do it. But, we just had one of those teams that wasn't going to quit.
What a game, though. Now, talk a little bit about Mike Scott. Of course, you faced him. Was that a splitter he was throwing, or was there something else with that baseball?
Well, he had a split, for sure. We also knew that he was cheating with scuffing balls because we had a bunch of them. We had a whole bag of them. We tried to show the umpires at Shea, that we had these balls, and they didn't want to hear nothing about it. We weren't the only ones that were saying that. The whole league was saying that. They had caught guys already doing it. So we were just saying, it is what it is, man.
What are you going to do, right? You can't fight City Hall.
I mean, we got to figure it out. Got to beat them somehow. So we were able to dodge that bullet, fortunately, in the last game.
You sure did. Now, moving on to the series, the famous Game 6. You came up in the ninth inning, but you didn't fare so well.
No. No, I came in. He wasn't sure he wanted me to bunt or what, so he told me to put the bunt on. The high fastball, I think it was off of Schiraldi, the high fastball, and I tried to pull it back and it tipped the bat. So, he got me in a good count to hit, and did another pitch. I think I fouled it off, and then a high fastball. I think I swung at that for strike three, but yeah, it was something where I got myself out, and that was not good.
Right, but thank goodness for Bill Buckner and for Mookie Wilson, because the Mets turned out okay that night. And, of course, as everybody knows, the rest is history.
I ended up staying at short. I came in for Elster. I hit for Elster.
Okay, yeah.
At a bat. I stayed in the game at shortstop, and I was actually on deck hitter when Mookie would get the ball first.
Amazing. So you had a bird's-eye view.
Yeah.
Definitely. Now, looking back at that ball club, Hojo, a lot of great names. You got Strawberry Hernandez, Doc Gooden. Wally Backman is kind of a puzzle to a lot of people. How do you feel he was treated by the Mets after his season at Vegas this year?
Well, I don't know the whole story, so I don't know, there was somebody at fault or not. I mean, the guy did everything he's supposed to at AAA. I know the guys that Wally, and we'd love to see an opportunity to manage or coach in the big league somewhere. So that, for that to happen, for Wally, he must have really felt that, things weren't going to work out for him there.
Yeah.
And, for him to make that move at this point, not try to stick it out. So whatever the reason was, it is what it is. I don't know all the details, but, I'm sure Wally's going to end up on his feet here somewhere.
We hope so. Yeah, good baseball man. Now, how do you feel about the supposed trials and tribulations of Doc Gooden? I mean, the guy's been through so much, and now they say he may be experiencing more problems. But he meant an awful lot to that 86 club.
Yeah, I love Doc. He was the heart and soul of the pitching staff, and when he pitched, it was special, an event. He went out there and just dominated other teams. And a lot of us had no idea that, that stuff was going on behind the scenes back then. But, we were hoping and we're praying that nothing happens to him now. But if there's an issue going on, that he gets help and they get that fixed. Because we don't want to lose that guy.
Definitely. Definitely not. You're exactly right. Howard Johnson with us tonight on Sports Talk 1240. Well, in 1987, Ray Knight becomes a free agent, and finally you're the sole third baseman, and you have a heck of a year. You have a surge in power, a surge in speed. Join that 30-30 club. What do you attribute that sudden surge to, Howard?
Well, I didn't really have a surge. It was more of just more at-bats. in the minor league days, I hit home runs. And I'd stole bases, and I just kind of did that because I could always do that. And when I was, younger in the big leagues, I just always had limited at-bats. And in 86, I think I had 220 at-bats. I had 10 homers and drove in 40 runs, and I think I stole 10 or 12 bases, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I told... They were asking me, newspaper guys were asking me, what do you expect, if you're an everyday guy? And I said, I think I'm going to hit 20 home runs and drive in 8. I could probably steal 20 bags. And they're like, really? And I said, he asked me how I came to that. And I said, well, I'm just doing the math.
Yeah.
So if I get more at bats, then I figure I'm going to be, you know, putting twice the numbers up. And that's exactly what happened. But I ended up, you know, just having that kind of, you know, year where everything kind of fell into place. And, you know, when you're going through it, you don't really, you know, first year playing every day, so you really don't even know what to expect at the end of the year. But, you know, needless to say, I was pretty happy about, you know, the way the year ended up for sure.
Sure did. Now, 88, disappointing finish as well. The loss to the Dodgers in the NLCS. How did that take the club?
Well, I know a lot of guys, you know, we were frustrated by that because, you know, we felt like we could have beat them. We, you know, we handled them so well during the year. We only had one loss against them all year, you know, during the season.
So sure, right.
For them to beat us, you know, I mean, some things had to happen that didn't happen at all against us or any other club. And it just happened that, you know, Dwight wasn't as sharp and their guys, you know, hit him. So she hit him. T-Bone Shelby hit him, and these are those things that we had opportunities to put him away like we always had. Or, you know, Doc always put guys away, and it just didn't happen. So we just go there. We run into a buzzsaw with Hershiser, and that's what happened. We, all the guys to a man, know that we should have probably won that year and maybe another year.
Definitely. It was a ball club, a great ball club. Now, excuse me. There's another detriment coming in 1988 to stand as a roadblock, and that guy's name is Greg Jeffries.
Yep.
He a great hitter, showed great promise. Eventually moved to second base. Give us a little bit on Jeffries and your time with him.
Well, Jeffries he was a guy who was always touted, you know,
right.
He could always hit. We saw that. He just had issues in the locker room. That was the biggest problem.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think the guys gave him a hard time, too. But, you know, he kind of brought a lot of it on himself. We just had the kind of team that wasn't going to put up with the stuff that, it was, you know, it was just about you. You know, I mean, it has to be the team first. And that's kind of the way, you know, this team was constructed and what's the way it worked.
Right.
And when you get players that come in, whether they're from the system, our own system, or from a trade or whatever, that, you know, they expected, the veteran guys especially expected you to fit in to what was working, and that was the only thing. I think Greg had a hard time with that.
Definitely. Now, you join Willie Mays and Barry Bonds as Bobby Bonds, excuse me, as the only multi-year 30-30 players. And Strawberry in 91 goes to L.A. So you're the leader of the offense, and you had a great year. You won two-thirds of the Triple Crown, so that was not bad.
No, it wasn't bad. I mean, I was that was my last good year, by the way, Bill. I just had my body started to give out after that.
Sure.
I didn't have it anymore. And I was 30 years old. I felt like I felt strong. I felt like I was at the peak, you know, 89 and 91. I felt like, physically, I was at the peak of my career, and, you know, just after that, I was sad that it just fell apart so fast, but it was one of those special years where it kind of fell into place, and I was able to get those numbers and get the third and final 30-30 and, you know, make it a special year, but we had a tough season. We didn't win. I know I think that was your Davey might have got fired.
Right, and Buddy takes over the reins. Yeah,
Buddy takes over. Buddy had a hard time. It was just a difficult year for us.
Yeah. Now you were moved to the outfield. That was during the time of the worst team money could buy. You have guys like Eddie Murray, Vince Coleman, Bobby Bonilla, Saber Hagen, high priced veterans, and everything tailed off after that, didn't it, Hojo?
Yeah. Everything just didn't click. The next year, Torborg came in as the manager, and I tried to go to center field, and it just wasn't happening. We just couldn't make it work. We had the players, we just couldn't make it work. And eventually, Torborg got fired, and Dallas Green came in. So it was just a changing of the guard at that point. That a lot of the older guys were going to be gone, and they were going to start with that youth movement.
Yeah, they went from Torborg, who was a player's guy, to the disciplinarian, Dallas Green. And I remember those days. Those were some rough times. We're speaking with Howard Johnson tonight on Sports Talk 1240. How did you enjoy your current role as manager of the High Desert Mavericks?
Good. It's good. I enjoy it. We had a really good team this year. The kids played good, and we stayed in it the whole year. We won the first half. Second half, we had a good year. Good second half of the season. We kept the core of the group together, which was nice. And, we sent some guys up. Some guys were traded. We lost some power during the year with trades. We lost some pitching, with a couple trades and some guys moving up. But we were able to piece it together and put together a nice run there at the end, and we ended up winning the whole thing.
You sure did. Are you coming back next year?
Yeah, I'm hopeful. Hopefully I'm in the big league somewhere with somebody. Maybe Texas, but if not, we'll see. Yeah.
What would you like your legacy to Met fans be, Hojo? I mean, they remember you those great years with the power, the speed. What would you want a Met fan to think of when they think of Howard Johnson?
Definitely that. The numbers and all that, but somebody cares about the Mets and wants them to do well. So that's, and at some point I'm hoping that we get some guys like Kenny or Wally, myself, those guys running things on the field.
Definitely.
So that's what I'm looking forward to is that day, hopefully.
Excellent. Well, Howard Johnson, it's been an honor and a pleasure speaking with you tonight. I thank you for spending part of your Sunday night with us. It was great.
All right, Bill. Appreciate it, man.
You take care.
Watch this Bucks game now.
Okay, you go to it. Now that's Howard Johnson, folks. Next up, we'll talk to perhaps the greatest male tennis player of all time, Rod Laver. So stay with us, folks.
Listening to Sports Talk 1240 on Long Island's AM 1240. WGBB.
Country Foot Care, official podiatrists of the New York Lizards, have been delivering state-of-the-art foot care with good old-fashioned caring to Long Island residents for over 30 years. Specialists in sports medicine and foot injuries, Country Foot Care can be reached at 516-741-FEET or online at countryfootcare.com.
Want to advertise your business on Sports Talk 1240? Place an ad on sportstalk1240.com and run a radio commercial during the show every Sunday night here on AM 1240 WGBB. Our rates are very affordable. We'll even produce the radio commercial for you. Just head over to sportstalk1240.com and fill out the Contact Us form and let us start promoting your business today.
Unflippable, unflappable, unleakable. The Gust Buster is the only umbrella that won't flip inside out, rip, tear, or leak. Capable of withstanding winds over 55 miles per hour. All of our umbrellas are constructed of the finest quality materials and backed by a limited lifetime guarantee. What are you waiting for? Visit GustBuster.com and get your Gust Buster today.
Stay connected to Sports Talk 1240 by following us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Sports Talk 1240.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240, broadcasting every Sunday night beginning at 8 p.m. right here on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB, the station that serves your community. And now, back to the show.
All right, we're back with Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB, Freeport, New York. Bill Donahue with you. I hope you're enjoying Sports Talk 1240 tonight. New York baseball still giving us some thrills with the Baby Bombers in the Bronx. The Mets in their hunt for the wild card, 17-0 today over the Philadelphia Phillies. They scored more points than the New York Jets did. And that's not difficult these days. Of course, the baseball world turned upside down today by the tragic death of Marlins pitcher Jose Fernandez in a boating accident. Just horrible news from Miami. And the Mets, of course, will be still turned on to that story when they visit the Marlins this week for three games in Miami. And, of course, the Miami Marlins will be in mourning for their great teammate, Jose Fernandez. I believe my next guest is widely regarded as one of the greatest in tennis history. He was the number one ranked professional from 1964 to 1970, spanning 4 years before and 3 years after the start of the Open era. His 200 singles titles are the most in tennis history, and he holds the all-time male singles record of 22 titles in a single season and seven consecutive years, winning at least 10 titles per season. He's the only player to twice achieve the calendar year Grand Slam in 62 and 69, and he remains the only man to do so during the Open era. He contributed to five Davis Cup titles for Australia. His new book from Triumph, our friends in Chicago, is titled Rod Laver, an Autobiography. I welcome to Sports Talk 1240 tonight the man himself, the legend, Rod Laver. Rod, good evening.
Yeah, hey, Bill, thank you. Pleasure to be here.
It's wonderful to have you, sir. Now, Dan Maskell, the voice of Wimbledon, described you as technically faultless. And Rex Bellamy, the writer, wrote, "The strength of that wrist and forearm give him blazing power without loss of control, even when he was on the run and at full stretch." Now, certainly great words, Rod, and deservedly so. How would you describe your playing style?
God, not like that, I'm sure. I went for a lot of shots. I had a coach back in the, probably 14 through 16 years of age. And he told me, he says, left-handers that, yes, you've got a good forehand, but you generally have got a little chip backhand and it's not going to win Wimbledon. So he says, you've got to try and hit it flat or hit topspin on it. And so that was where I started off with. A whippy forehand,
right,
and then a backhand that I was not strong enough really to control it. And I got into the age of 18, 19, all of a sudden, I had the control over that backhand. And so that probably, puts me in that category. I was probably the only one really as a lefty to put topspin on my backhand side. And maybe that was, it was probably 90% of my game because they always came to my backhand thinking that's the weakest shot on a lefty.
Uh-huh.
But mine was probably was better than the forehand.
Uh-huh. Okay. Excellently described, Rod. Yeah, definitely. Now, you were coached down in Queensland at your home by Charlie Hollis and later by the Australian Davis Cup team captain Harry Hopman. They gave you the name Rocket. Describe the influence those two gentlemen had on your career, Rod.
Yeah, well, I was very fortunate in Rockhampton where Charlie Hollis was working. He was a family friend. I had two elder brothers, and they, they'd knock me off the court. They'd say, "Hey, take it off. Take a hike, kid." And so I found myself, learning all my tennis up there. Then, of course, when I became good enough to travel south into Sydney, Melbourne, Adelaide, in Australia. It gave me, that chance to go to Harry Hopman then. And Harry Hopman, of course, had coached the Davis Cup teams, for the last probably 30 years prior to me.
Mm-hmm.
So, I was fortunate to catch, a great coach that gave me the ground strokes and a technical guy that could tell you where you should be at any given time in a match. And I think that was a great help because, he was certainly a taskmaster for a lot of things, but he got you as fit as any person, on a court. And so that, I think, got me started from the first into the power game, I guess you'd call it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, the way I started off. And being probably a little lackadaisical, not necessarily slow, but I could always get to the ball, but I'd wait for the last minute to get to it. So he sort of took the rocket on, but he called it the Rockhampton Rocket.
Okay.
Where I was from. And that was the nickname.
Excellent. Okay, now, you captured your first Wimbledon singles crown in 61. In 62, you become the first male player since Don Budge in 38 to win all four Grand Slam singles titles in the same year. And you won an additional 18 titles for the 22. Which of the Grand Slam tournaments, Rod, meant the most to you, do you think?
You know, I sometimes think about that and never come up with a real answer.
Yeah.
The first time had to be the most difficult. But, you know, you're playing amateurs, but at the same time, I didn't know anything any better. I did actually, when I was in 1956, when I traveled overseas, you know, I was in Forest Hills, you know, where the U.S. championships were held back in those years.
Right.
And Lou Hode was there, and Lou was going for the Grand Slam, too. And he was, if he wins this match, he's playing Rosewall in the final. And if he wins this match, he will have won the Grand Slam. And I'm watching it. And so I had a first-hand knowledge of, you know, what a Grand Slam was. And I think that probably gave me some thoughts on, you know, what this game is. And, you know, I played, you know, in 61 and 62, you know, was a great grooming of being able to go around the world and play these contests. And so I just felt happy competing. And I think, you know, you have to be fortunate. You have to be very fortunate a lot of times because, you know, not only injuries, but, you know, then you got to think of health. You know, and
right.
Colds and flu and sickness and anything, because it starts in January and it ends in September. So you've got 9 months to have a lot of things go wrong, and you've got to get up from, you know, four times in a year. You've got to bring yourself to a peak, you know, in practice and efforts from coaching. And so, you know, I feel very fortunate that it came to me this way.
You sure were, right? Now, the rare champion that you are, you excelled on all surfaces that were played in your time, grass, clay, hard surface, carpet, and wood parquet. What was your favorite surface, and how did you have to alter your strategy based on the surface that you were playing on?
Well, you know, actually, you have to remember all the Grand Slams except, you know, the clay court championships in Paris was the French championships. All the others were on grass.
Right, they were on grass at that time. Right.
And so what I think I probably at the beginning, you know, because of my left-handed serve, you know, grass was probably, you know, a good suit for my game. And so I probably went that way. But I really in 1960, 1961, somewhere in there, I want to learn how to play on clay courts. And I went to all the tournaments in Europe and just kept playing on them. And I said, I'm just thinking to myself, why are these clay court champions, Nicky Pietrangeli and Orlando Cirola and Santana, I found out what they were doing to our opponents. We as Australians really didn't play much on it, so we didn't understand the mechanics.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that helped me there. But I think the only thing, when you mentioned that I was proficient on cement courts, but we didn't really play on cement. You know, when open tennis came, we went into the WCT circuit, which was the, you know, Lamar Hunt had a carpet. It was like a carpet court that you put down over an indoor court or an indoor basketball court.
Uh-huh.
And that was one. But then you went into cement and hard courts, which, of course, the U.S. have mostly, you know, the hard courts. So, you know, it was a learning curve. The balls, you know, in that position, particular time, the ball would bounce a lot higher on the cement, where on grass it would bounce pretty low, and on clay courts it would be a slower bounce. So you didn't have to adjust too much. But now, of course, you don't. You just have one court, which is grass, and the rest is on a synthetic surface or hard courts. So, you know, the game has changed, you know, a lot from the wooden rackets that we used.
Right.
Now, of course, you've got the composite rackets that are, you know, unbelievably good to play on. You know, they're so easy, you know, to play the game. And I think the social level players, you know, really enjoy the bigger headed rackets.
Sure.
The little wood rackets with the small head, you know, you have to be reasonably talented. Otherwise, it's hard to play on that. So tennis really boomed when the composite rackets came out.
Definitely, yeah. It's exactly right, Rod. Now, before the Open era, we talk about the Open era. Describe that for the fans who may not be familiar with that.
Well, the Open era, to begin with, I learned the game in the amateur world.
Right.
And the amateur world, you know, was the likes of, you know, Sedgman and McGregor and Hoad, Rosewall, Cooper, Anderson, all the way along. And then Open tennis, you know, wasn't thought of yet. The amateur tennis, you know, was one. But then if you felt like you could turn professional and be able to play, you know, against other professionals like Gonzalez or Sedgman or Hoad, who were professionals, you know, that was sort of a money game. So you turn pro from amateur tennis, you had to give up. There was no more Wimbledon for you to play in. No U.S., no French, no, you know, no Australian.
Right.
So, you know, you divorced yourself from the amateur game, turned professional. And then in 1967, Wimbledon, yeah, which is in my book that we've been talking about, you know, the chairman of the All England Club, which is Wimbledon, came out to one of our big tournaments in London and sort of said, why do I have to come out here to watch you? Because last year you were at Wimbledon playing. So, you know, why do I have to come out here for this? And of course the answer was, of course we were pros and amateurs and pros can't play together. And so that was when, you know, he said, you know, in 1967, we're going to have a pro Wimbledon 2 weeks after the amateur Wimbledon, and which we did. And then he said, the next year, we're just going to call everybody tennis players. That's all you're going to be called.
Okay.
And then, of course, the Australian, the French, and the U.S. all got together and says, why don't we have open tennis? Which means there is no amateurs and in the pros. And now you've got a prize money structure that anybody, anywhere can play. And that really, you know, that now, of course, is open tennis.
Exactly. What a wonderful point that you made there, Rod. Now, describe the atmosphere, if you would, for us at Forest Hills for the younger fans who are really only familiar with the massive affair that they hold in Flushing Meadow every year.
Oh, God. It's such a change.
Exactly,
you know,
yeah.
Forest Hills was in the 20s, I think, when that stadium was built out at the Westside Tennis Club. And it was an amateur championship, not a championship, an amateur club. And it, you know, they had like 25 or 27 grass courts. And it was, you know, it had a lot of history. You know, when you look at, you know, the Jack Kramers or the Pancho Gonzalez, mm-hmm. you know, they all played at the Forest Hills. And it was, you know, it was a big stadium. It probably held 11 or 12,000, and it had a lot of history there. But of course, you know, you just knew it's an amateur club, so how do you make this tournament bigger? But you know, that's when they found that they could move it to the out onto Long Island a little bit further and have a big stadium, which and now holds 26,000 people.
Right.
It's a beautiful stadium. Almost, I think, is too big for tennis.
Yeah.
The size of it, and if you're up in the cheap seats, way up high, you know, yeah, it's hard to know how high the net is, you know, what balls are going over the net and what ones are hitting the net. But it's a great thing, and I'm just honored that someone like Arthur Ashe's name is on that stadium, because I feel that he and I were good friends. We played a lot of finals, a lot of semifinals, and I was, you know, was thrilled that, you know, the stadium went to the size it did. And now, of course, you've got a lot, about three stadiums out there,
right,
which are magnificent stadiums. So, you know, the game is just transferred from the amateur world to a huge open game. And to see that, you know, on the men's final, and I think the women's were exactly the same, I think it was 3 million, you know, dollars to win the tournament this year. So, I mean, you can just see the thoughts in young people's head, you know, like families, mothers and fathers saying, you look like 10 or 11 years or 12 years of age, and it starts to see a wonderful talent evolving. And so that, you know, all of a sudden, we're going to make you a tennis player.
Right.
And so that is what's happened to the game now. You have so many, you know, young people. We haven't got the talent maybe that has picked up the game yet, you know, in the U.S., you know, and which I'm so surprised at. I would think that there'd be a lot of guys knocking at the door to win all these tournaments, but you know, it will happen here within probably 10 years, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But it's something where in Australia, when we look back at the times, you know, when I see Sajan and McGregor and Oden, Rosewall and Cooper and Anderson and Newcomb and Roach, you know, how did these guys all become good? And I think it's just purely, you know, champions breed champions.
Mm-hmm.
And your competition is always being pushed, and I think that's where I feel, you know, tennis is here in the U.S. because it should be this natural talent. I know the USTA have got a huge development down in Orlando, with 101 courts being put in,
right,
and that is going to be a feeding area for all these youngsters.
What an idea. Yeah, what a concept, Rod. We're speaking to the great Rod Laver tonight on Sports Talk 1240. Now, we keep mentioning Ken Rosewall. Now, you had a great rivalry on the court with Ken. And then there was that legendary match out at Wembley in 1964. Give us a little insight into that, Rod.
In 1964, now you're pushing me back.
Me too.
Yeah, no, actually, the Wembley Empire Pool was the world professional title that we professionals, back when I turned away from the amateurs. And Ken and I, yes, I think we had a long five-setter there too. But it was that opportunity to play, you know, to the English crowd. The English crowds are probably the most knowledgeable crowds, you know, in the world when it comes to watching matches and enjoying tennis. And of course, you know, Ken and I don't hit the ball for winners. We have to maneuver our game with a wooden racket. So, you know, that was sort of a pretty good challenge. You know, I guess the one that I remember playing Ken Rosewall in 1972 when it was the WCT finals in Dallas. And that was one that took me away. It was 7-5 in the tiebreaker in the fifth set after probably 4 hours of tennis. So, you know, Ken and I had a lot of close battles. You know, I had my share of wins, but so did he. He had a lot of great champions. But he and I and Lou Hode, when I first turned professional down in Australia, they used to beat up on me fairly good in 1963, and I had to learn how the game was really played as a professional. And so when open tennis then came along in 1968, you know, I'd been given five years of lessons from Hode and Rosewall and Gonzalez. And so, you know, I went back to Wimbledon in 1968, and you know, it seemed to me in a way that it was actually it was pretty simple tennis. And I enjoyed every part of it, but I had so much power pushed into the game because I played Lou Hode, you know, in I think 13 matches, and I didn't win one of them. And
boy,
so I learned a pretty quick lesson that, you know, I better improve my game in all categories, you couldn't serve any doubles. You couldn't have a little short second serve. You shouldn't miss your first volley. You returned all the balls. So, you know, from a serve. And so, you know, once you've learned all that and you've still got some legs to play. And when open tennis came, I was 31 at this stage. And so I had some legs left.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a learning curve. But the reason why I wrote the book, you know, Bill, was that I felt that the amateur tennis world is not going to be, it's not going to be known anymore. And when I turned pro, you know, I had that portion of it, and then open tennis came. So, you know, it gave me three sections in the book, and I think that to me was the reason why I put it into play.
Okay. Yeah, excellent book. The book is titled Rod Laver, an Autobiography. It's from our friends at Triumph. Now, the foreword of the book is done by Roger Federer. Now, in the modern era, Rod, we have guys such as McEnroe, Connors, the great Bjorn Borg, Pete Sampras, and Federer and Djokovic of today. Mm-hmm. What are your opinions of some of these players?
Well, they're all great champions in their era. And I think that today in today's world, with Djokovic and Nadal and Murray, you know, all these players coming along, I think, you know, someone like Roger Federer has made a mark, you know, in the world with his 17 titles that he's won, you know, of all the four majors. But, you know, prior to that, you know, you're looking at, I came along at the last passion part of Bjorn Borg. We played some matches. We played some tournaments against each other. And, you know, I thought he was unbelievable as a clay courter, you know, because he won the French like five times in a row. Mm-hmm. And then he'd go over to Wimbledon and he'd win the Wimbledon title five times at least in a row. And so you know how much talent he had, but then you're looking at people, you know, that came along with Vitas Gerulaitis and John McEnroe.
Right.
Those two came along, but you know who coached them? Not all, maybe all the time, but it was Harry Hopman.
Uh-huh.
He found those two at Port Washington.
Yeah.
And in New York, and it's amazing how he's able to instill, you know, great things in a player, you know. And I think, you know, I think McEnroe still remembers someone like Hopman being, you know, instrumental in, you know, I know when I talked to John a bunch of times, he says, you know, your name came up all the time, you know, with Hopman. And so, you know, you felt like he could pull out so much out of a player. So Vitas and John were, you know, great champions and played some, you know, wonderful matches against each other. And of course, when you look at, you know, what John did in the amateur world, that he, you know, was a great champion. He had Wimbledon, that long tiebreaker against Borg. You know, so, you know, there's a lot of matches that you can put your hand to and say, hey, you know, you must remember some of these matches. And that's the reason why the history of the game is so important. And I think when we, you know, Roger Federer and I, you know, we hit it off pretty well as being good friends, and you know, we've done quite a few things together. And it was, you know, it was one of those things that, you know, when you're looking at what Federer has done in his life, and he said, you know, I want to hope that we can keep something alive of the amateur world. And that's where the Laver Cup, which is the European players against the rest of the world, and that is going to happen next year in Prague. So,
excellent.
You know, it's a new tournament, and Nadal and Federer said that they're going to play in the first ones at least. So, you know, I think someone like Federer is so good for the game. He does so much, you know, socially, you know, with with various players that he knows, and you know, and the game is getting bigger and bigger. And Roger, unfortunately, he's in a position where he's probably only got a couple of years left.
Right.
You know, because he's getting a little old. He's 34, 35 years of age. So, you know, he's got some wonderful stories to tell.
He sure does, I bet. Now, taking yourself out of the equation, Rod, we've got the great Rod Laver with us tonight on Sports Talk 1240. Who do you feel is the greatest ever, Rod?
The one thing I find myself always going to is that whatever era you're in, because now it's getting a little more specialized because the wooden rackets against graphite rackets, and I thought, you know, in the era of the Hode, Rosewall, Cooper, Anderson, McKay, Buchholz, in that era, you know, I'd have to put my money on Lou Hode, mm-hmm. as being, you know, the great of that era. And then when you get into, you know, the era of Sampras and Agassi, you know, I think they're sort of a match up.
Oh yeah,
of being the best in that era. And now, you know, yes, I felt like I did pretty well through my era, so I'd be in that era. But now you're looking at the open world, and at the moment, I see Roger Federer as being like the number one player in the world, even though, you know, the last two, three years, you know, Djokovic has proved that he's won so many of the majors as well as regular tournaments on the circuit that, you know, his game has improved. He found himself maybe wasn't as fit as he should have been. He wasn't as flexible. And so he took maybe 6 months off and got a new nutrition and then hired people to teach him the mechanics of being flexible. And so he's fit now. He's healthy. And unfortunately, at the U.S. Open this year, you know, I think Stanley Wawrinka, who mm-hmm. played him in the final, you know, played one of his best matches that he's ever played. And so, you know, his I know what still he wasn't shoes, but just the speed of play, you know, he ended up having blisters all over his feet. So
sure,
you know, that, you know, and he's prepared to put in all the amount of time he needs to be a champion. And
right. Well, Rod Laver, I tell you, it's been a real honor having you with us tonight. I thank you for taking the time out of your Sunday night to be with us. The book is called Rod Laver, an Autobiography. It's from our friends at Triumph Books in Chicago, available on Amazon.com, available from TriumphBooks.com. Thank you again, Rod.
Yeah, Bill, my pleasure. I really very appreciate it.
Take care, my friend.
Yeah.
Rod Laver, folks. That'll do it for me tonight on Sports Talk 1240. I'd like to thank my guests, Howard Johnson and the great Rod Laver, my engineer, Brian Graves, and, of course, you for joining us. Stay tuned for hour number two. Paul Spiteri will be with you in just a moment. Phil Donahue, wishing you a good evening, folks.
Expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.